From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, exploring consciousness with David Wilcock. But here's what's happening. My, oh my, what is Google up to? First, your personal information. Now they want your blood. Google has patented a needle-free blood draw, which holds appeal for diabetes patients who have to test their blood glucose levels on a regular basis. The patent, which was published on December 3rd, describes a device that uses an abrupt surge of gas to give a microparticle enough momentum to pierce a person's skin, and then a microemergence of blood is drawn into a barrel. But the big story is, the company is obviously mum about its intentions for this patent, which is still pending. What do they want to do with blood? Strange. Farmers need to dramatically cut the amount of antibiotics used in agriculture because of the threat to human health, according to a report. Some infections are becoming almost impossible to treat because of the excess use of antibiotics. The expert, of course, on all these kinds of diseases, Gary Ridenour. Doctor, what's going on here? We've always felt they're putting too many things in animals, haven't we?
Right, and George, you and I know that for decades we've been fighting over antibiotics and growth hormones in animals, and one of the problems is that there haven't been any good studies to show that there's resistance happening. But we do know that the antibiotics make the animals grow larger and they have less infections. And the antibiotics are subtherapeutic, but they're appearing in milk and they're appearing in our meat. And if we take all the antibiotics out, that will be great. The only problem is the prices of meat and eggs will skyrocket because of the problems with trying to raise the animals.
I'm convinced, too, that the bovine, which they used to put in cows, has pushed and propelled our younger kids. They're growing up way too fast, Gary.
That is a possibility. And cooking the meat may not kill the bacteria, the antibiotics and the growth hormones that are in the meat right now. So it's basically, the CDC sampled 800 cows out of 80,000. But found multiple antibiotics in a lot of the meat and sent warning letters out to dairies telling them that they're using too much chemicals.
So the big story here, farmers urged to cut antibiotic use in animals. Thanks, Doc. Really appreciate it. 30 Boston College students, including at least 8 members of the men's basketball team, complained of gastrointestinal symptoms after eating at Chipotle, the restaurant. It was not immediately known if the illnesses were part of a national outbreak of E. coli, which has been linked to the Denver-based chain. Boy, they're getting all kinds of problems. Food safety coach Jeff Nelkin. Jeff, this seems to be following them. What's going on?
Well, I think we're in the stages of putting the information together. We still haven't detailed exactly the pathway or the cross-contamination, and Chipotle is taking a lot of testing of product in the hopes and, redesigning their food safety program to be a little bit more robust. And for those listeners that have any concerns, CDC now has a location called Vital Signs, which gives you an update on any spreading of bacteria across county lines.
Well, I got to tell you, it's not good for their business, is it?
No, certainly not. And I think it gives everybody an opportunity to think about when you do go to restaurants and you see any behavior that could contribute to contamination, that it's everyone's responsibility to bring it to the attention of the manager or the supervisor on duty. We all need to be part of the solution.
Chipotle, they're having their problems. Thanks, Jeff. The death of John Lennon 35 years ago still reverberates as a defining moment for a generation and for the music world. A man who helped define rock and roll, a leader of the peace movement, an icon of the baby boom generation. His sudden shooting death at the hands of Mark David Chapman inspired shock and mourning, and for many marked the end of an era. Chapman was sentenced to 20 years to life in prison. He was last denied parole in August of 2014. He has told the parole board, "I'm sorry for causing that type of pain." Well, to the owner of three abandoned Boeing 747 jets, please contact the Kuala Lumpur International Airport's Lost and Found Department. Malaysian aviation authorities placed an ad in a newspaper there asking for the untraceable owner of three. How could this be? Three 747s which have been left at the airport to come forward and reveal his or her identity. Three 747s. They have no idea how they got there, who put them there, or who owns them. That doesn't sound good. In Hartford, Connecticut, a man described by police as a Santeria priest caught with human remains in his Connecticut home agreed to go on to Massachusetts to face accusations that he stole the five skeletons from a mausoleum. Wall Street opening lower as shares of energy companies and miners were dragged down by a continued slide in oil prices and fears of a global economic slowdown on weak Chinese trade data. The price of oil, the barrel, is just going down, down, and down. I think $37 a barrel now, U.S. crude. Can't believe how low that is. Up next, we're going to be talking about The Last Volcano, the special book by Dr. John Dvorak. It's about volcanoes, and they could be planet killers. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've got one heck of a program for you tonight. Well, let me introduce Dr. John Dvorak for you, PhD in planetary geophysics from the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. He's worked for the United States Geological Survey, studying volcanoes, beginning with Mount St. Helens in 1980, and including eruptions in Indonesia and the Hawaiian Islands. He is the author of The Last Volcano, which tells an incredible story. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to have him tell what that incredible story is. John, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Well, hello, George. It's great to talk to you again.
You too. And nice job on this, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Pulled out the personality of the professor who died in 1953, didn't he?
That's right. He lived to be 82.
All right. Tell us a little bit about Professor Thomas Jagger.
Well, he's the one who pioneered the modern study of volcanoes. And he was originally, he was educated at Harvard. He was head of geology at MIT. And in 1912, he gave all that up. And he came out here to the Hawaiian Islands, and he started a science station, a volcano observatory. And he studied volcanoes, traveled the world for 50 years. He had many adventures, but that's not even the most appealing part of him. To me, what was most appealing is that in all of these adventures, he actually found what most people are searching for. He found true love. He found this woman. She was a widowed school teacher from California. She had come out to the Hawaiian Islands to restart her life. And the two of them ran this volcano observatory without pay, studying the eruptions. Their house was right perched on the edge of the crater. They could look toward an active lava lake. And what really attracted me was how incredibly romantic the story was.
It almost sounds like something happening on Pompeii from Mount Vesuvius or something, doesn't it?
That's right. What they had was a house, and they went to bed, and they looked out, and their bedroom was filled up with the glow of the lava.
My gosh. So let's talk a little bit, John, about these volcanoes, because some of them are planet killers, aren't they?
They certainly are able to change the history of a planet. That's for sure, especially the life on the planet.
What's happening today in terms of volcanic activity? And I'll throw in earthquakes, too, because we're concerned about a big one in Southern California. We're concerned about one up near Seattle. We're concerned about the New Madrid Fault. But in terms of volcanoes and earthquakes, what's going on right now? Increasing, decreasing? What's happening?
Well, right now, right this moment, it's a rather quiet time.
That's good. Maybe that's good.
Well, it does change, as you know. The most active volcano in the United States is the one I live on, Kilauea, and I can actually see the glow from my house. Probably one of the most active in the world right now is Etna. It's been pouring out quite a bit of lava ever since August. But at this moment, it's rather quiet. And that is, of course, going to change at some unknown time in the future.
When volcanic activity, John, is quiet, does that mean the pressure is building up and then a big one is imminent?
Well, we would have to look at a specific case. And, of course, one that people look at is in Wyoming, that wonderful park.
The caldera.
That's right, a caldera, an explosive one. It's able to cause some of the largest explosions ever known on the planet at Yellowstone.
That was 600,000 years ago?
The last really huge one was 600,000. There was a very large steam eruption, about 75,000. And so those are very infrequent. But those types of eruptions are possible. The last, of course, really huge blast was the one in the Philippines, and that's been about, let's see, that was 1991, so that's some 24 years ago. A huge blast like Pinatubo will occur once or twice or three times a century, and of course there are many possibilities happening during the 21st century.
Well, didn't Iceland have one, John, that really disrupted European air traffic?
Yes. And I have to say, I cannot pronounce the names of the Icelandic volcanoes. But there was one.
The great part about that is you could say anything you want. Nobody's going to know.
Well, that's right. but they have very, very interesting names. This particular one threw a lot of ash in the air. And in today's world, if you throw a lot of stuff in the atmosphere, it will paralyze the air traffic. And that's what happened to Europe. Planes couldn't fly, and so that really had a big influence on the economy. So even if you don't live within sight of an active volcano, even if you've never stood on one, a vigorous eruption could have a big impact on your life.
Well, and that's part of the problem, too, is when these volcanoes spew, and this ash, let's say, covers the sunlight for who knows how long, that could throw the planet into a huge ice age, a deep freeze, can it?
It certainly can. There's the famous one of the eruption of Tambora, 1816. That's in Indonesia. And that threw so much ash and caused the cooling of the earth that was actually referred to as the year without a summer. The summer of 1817, in July, it snowed in Boston and New York, in parts of Virginia.
In the summer?
In the summertime. It snowed.
My gosh.
It also created quite a bit of a famine in Europe. It was part of the reason that people left New York and headed for the Midwest, hoping for better places to farm. And so, yes, it can cause quite a bit of havoc, and not just in a local area, but throughout the planet.
And there's really not much you can do, is there, John?
No. For a volcanic eruption, there really isn't a great deal that you can do. And you certainly can't even construct things. I mean, as we move over to earthquakes, there are ways of constructing buildings to withstand mm-hmm. earthquake shaking. But that's not going to happen with the volcano.
In your opinion, if we were to take a hit from a volcano or a big earthquake, which would you prefer?
Well, that has many answers to it. A volcanic eruption is the most awesome thing which you can imagine. I've seen them. I've seen them up close. And it's the only time that I can say I was truly awed, and I went beyond being scared. It was such a magnificent sight of seeing this rock rise up out of the ground. A molten red rock, thousands and thousands of feet, and just the deafening roar. I mean, I was struck by it.
Now, where you are, Kilauea, that yes. volcano that volcano has been spewing for how long now?
Well, the current eruption started in January 1983.
83.
And it has been slowly pouring out lava.
32 right? years.
That's right. But the rate of lava production has not been very high compared to, let's say, Etna, or the nearby wood of Mauna Loa. It's also been going in for most of the time into the national park. Now, you might remember a year ago, it was heading toward one of the communities here.
That's right.
And there was certainly a great deal of concern and a lot of discussion and a great deal of response from Red Cross and Civil Defense and so forth as to the progress of the lava. And it came up. It did take one building, and it came within maybe 100 feet of a main highway, and then it stopped.
But it's still spewing. So when you say it stopped, what did it do? Change direction? Go somewhere else?
But that's exactly right. This particular lava flow stopped, and then the plumbing system apparently sort of clogged up. And up at the summit of the volcano, we actually, the crater actually filled with lava and overflowed. And for about 3 weeks, it was just shoulder-to-shoulder people watching this fantastic display of molten lava fountaining and flowing in the crater.
Why doesn't it stop?
Well, it doesn't stop because, well, on the simple question is, this is all part of the Earth trying to cool down. The Earth is hot inside.
Right.
And so the reason we have mountains building, the reason we have eruptions, the reason we have earthquakes, is that's the heat getting released out of the planet.
It's like a pressure cooker.
Well, that's right. It's hot inside, and hot things cool down. And this is how the planet Earth cools down.
Well, if anybody's cooked something that has any kind of consistency to it, and you start to boil it, you can see small craters, almost volcano size, popping up from whatever you're cooking.
That's right.
Same thing.
Many people make an analogy with things like oatmeal.
That's right.
And you watch oatmeal bubble and boil and burst and little craters form and sometimes even little mounds form.
But now what creates the explosion?
Well, the explosions, and this is going back with our friend in my book, Professor Jagger. When he started 100 years ago, people didn't even know why volcanoes erupted or exploded. And he was one of those who answered the question, why? And that's because there's gas in the molten material itself, in the magma. And when it's inside the Earth, it's dissolved inside the liquid. And then as it rises and gets to lower pressure, the bubbles start to form. It's just like a bottle of champagne.
Okay.
It's just like a soda can. You shake up the can of soda, you open it up, and you have a little eruption right there.
But in this case, it's highly inflammable, right?
It's very explosive, yes. It's very, very explosive. It can shoot things up to the highest part of the atmosphere.
And can we predict with any kind of accuracy when a volcano is going to blow up? Are there signs?
Well, there are certainly signs, and we're much better now than we were even 10 years ago. And it's the classic signs, and these signs were first identified by Professor Jagger, and there's the ones that you'll read in any little geology textbook. There'll be an uplift of the ground because magma comes into the volcano and the whole thing actually inflates. It's like you're on the outside of a balloon and you actually rise up. Earthquakes will start and the Earth will start to shake. And at places like Mount St. Helens, it was almost like standing on jello. It shook so much. And then there's also gases coming out, in particular sulfur dioxide and carbon dioxide coming out. And as those levels increase, we know that the magma is starting to release its gases faster and faster.
What a great science, John. It really is. What country has the most active volcanoes right now?
Well, the United States.
Us? Really?
That's right. And that's because the United States, we have all those in the west, out in there in the west, Mount St. Helens, Yellowstone, and, of course, all of the Aleutians. And then you have to remember the ones in the Marianas, over in the West Pacific, like the island of Pagan.
How many do we have?
There's about 150 active ones.
150 active volcanoes.
That's right.
That's kind of frightening. John, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back in a moment. Dr. John Dvorak with us, his book, The Last Volcano. It's an incredible story about the father of modern-day volcanology. We're going to be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls on earthquakes and volcanoes with Dr. John Dvorak, author of The Last Volcano. I've got much more to talk with him about, though, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Dr. John Dvorak with us. John, when Thomas Jaeger was involved in volcanoes, and he truly was one of the first in the modern era to study tornadoes as a science, what was it that got his interest in them?
Well, what got his interest is the eruption of Mount Pelee on the island of Martinique down the Caribbean in 1902. This was the big news story of 1902. It was At first, it was hard to believe it had happened. And that is, there was a city of 25,000 people who were instantly killed by the volcano. And he was one of the few people who went down to study it. And he was very much impressed by both the power of the volcano and the people who survived and told him about that. And as a result of that, he decided he would spend the rest of his life studying active volcanoes.
Well, he made good on that promise, didn't he?
He certainly did. He lived a life that I envy.
You have looked at planet killers from volcanoes. How many have there been that we truly know of?
On the planet Earth?
Yeah.
Well, one of the mysteries is that when a volcano erupts, it can certainly wipe out life in that general area, but nobody's been able to pinpoint sort of global extinction with a volcanic eruption. Now, that's not to say that they can't be huge. Yellowstone is huge. The largest volcanic explosion that anyone has found in the geologic record actually occurred in southeast Colorado. And it produced something like over 600 to 700 cubic miles of material was erupted.
That's a lot of material, John.
That's right. It probably was erupted within a few hours and certainly within a few weeks. I mean, almost all of this stuff came out in very, very short order.
Now, you said something interesting when I said, tell me about the planet killers. You said on this planet, which implies that there have been planet killers on other planets. Is that the case?
Well, there certainly is volcanic activity, and it is surprisingly, we see it all throughout the planet. We see evidence of volcanic activity just pretty much lists the rocky planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. We see it on the moons of Jupiter, Saturn, and, of course, the big surprise, and we're still not sure what it means or how it happens, it looks like there was even a volcano on Pluto.
So, and that volcano would spew what, lava or ice or what?
Well, it's too cold out there for it even to erupt water ice. So it's probably erupting nitrogen.
Okay, now let's talk a little bit, if we can, John, about earthquakes. Because they seem to be extremely dangerous and pressing as well. The last big one in California was Northridge years ago that caused considerable damage.
Oh, yes.
What will it take for a big what in your opinion, is a big earthquake?
Well, to me, a big earthquake, the one at Northridge is a large moderate quake. That was still in the magnitude 6 range, like 6.5, as I recall, 6.7. And then, of course, the one that occurred during the World Series in 1989, the one that's known as Loma Prieta, that was about a 6.8. And that, again, is the large edge of moderate. A big earthquake is like 1906 in San Francisco. That's almost a magnitude 8.
And then Fukushima was what?
Oh, that's a huge. That's up close to 9.
Indonesia, the one that killed over 200,000 people.
Right, the Sumatra one is like a 9. And the one that last occurred in the Pacific Northwest in January 29 in the year 1700 at about 9 o'clock in the morning, that was probably close to a magnitude 9 earthquake.
What is the biggest registered earthquake on the Richter scale?
Well, the largest one that's been recorded ever since we've had instruments, which is about 100 years, is the 1961 in Chile. And that is somewhere 9293. And then right behind it is Alaska in 1964, the one that occurred on Good Friday.
Right. And how high up do they go? 10?
Well, as Charles Richter would say, there's no limit to my scale. There's just a limit to what planet Earth does. And planet Earth, because of the size of the planet and because of the physical characteristics of rock, probably will produce something like the Chile earthquake, something like a 9.3, 9.2, maybe a 9.5 is the largest that this planet can happen.
John, is there ever a danger that an earthquake could be so big that it could split the planet maybe hundreds and hundreds of miles wide, or that a volcano could be so big it could literally blow off a part of the planet?
No, because of the finite strength of rock, it probably wouldn't build up to that kind of pressure. When you're talking about splitting planets or such, what we're really talking here is a massive impact. Something like the size of the moon striking the Earth would certainly do it.
That would do it. Could we blow up internally? Could this planet just explode all of a sudden?
No. What we're seeing is very well established in the geologic record. We don't live in a, in terms of earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, this has been very normal for a very long time.
Your book is called The Last Volcano. Tell me why you called it that.
Well, The Last Volcano. Well, I mean that as a metaphor in a very broad sense. Professor Jagger, the subject of the book, he spent 50 years traveling, studying volcanoes. And as he was approaching the end of his life, he knew that his career was coming to an end, and he knew there was going to be a last volcano. And so likewise, no matter who you are, and no matter what you do, you are eventually faced with the last something. For example, on your radio show is excellent, but perhaps in your mind, you know out there in the future, there is a last volcano for you, a last show. So that's what it means.
Well, the only last show for me is when I die.
Well, I'd be sorry when that day, but we all know
it's going to come.
That it's out there someplace.
Hopefully, it's way down the line.
Well, that's right. If you like to eat, you know there's a last meal down the road.
So, in your opinion, what's about to happen the quickest? The huge volcano or the huge earthquake over the next few years?
Well, if you're asking in the United States.
Yes.
In the United States, it's
probably... And North America, North America.
North America, it's probably large earthquake. And the reason I say that is the Western United States has been seismically quiet for a very long time. California has been quiet for barely 100 years, Pacific Northwest for 400 years. And we know that quietness is unusual. That's not normal in this part of the world. And so there is going to be, and the people in the know, the people who spend their careers studying this, the scientists, will say there's probably more than one out there in the future, too. In essence, as Charles Richter said, when you get a lot of earthquakes, you get a lot of earthquakes.
Well, you sure do. And this pressure that is building and building and building. Do you get a lot of swarms before the big one?
That is the big question. What is it going to be like just before? There are cases where that has happened and cases where it has not. Right now, nobody can actually tell you next week there will be a big earthquake. The only thing we can do right now is put it in terms of a probability. And the probability is essentially 100% that in our lifetime, there'll be one or more damaging earthquakes in California. Now, I'll probably live another 20, 30 years. So in the next 20, 30 years, there will probably be one or more damaging earthquakes.
Would you be surprised if it was in a month?
I wouldn't be surprised if it happens right now and the waves are moving across California.
Now, let's talk about tsunamis for a moment, John. Explain what's necessary in order to get one of those, a big tsunami.
Well, a tsunami is sort of like when you sit in the bathtub and you're sort of playing around and you move your hands up and down and you make waves.
Guys don't take baths anymore.
Well, a bath is very soothing, especially if you have bubbles. But it's the same if there's an earthquake and the floor of the ocean suddenly rises or falls. That's just like being in the bathtub, and it sends a wave out across the ocean. And when they run up, these can be very high. I forget the highest tsunami is probably, the one in Japan in 2011, I think that was somewhere around 60 feet.
A 60-foot wave coming your way.
That's right.
With incredible force.
That's right. If you remember those videos, it was just speechless.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
That water.
There is an area off the eastern coast of the United States, well off, La Palma.
Uh-huh.
And if that goes and creates a tsunami, I'm told it could wipe out the entire eastern coast of the United States. Is that true?
Well, one of the things we've learned about volcanoes out in the ocean, that the sides of them occasionally collapse, and that collapse will create a huge wave.
As the mass of the volcano sinks to the sea, you mean?
That's right. As it just slides, it's a gigantic landslide. It's happened here on the island of Hawaii a number of times. The last one was about 100,000 years ago, and so there's the question whether the volcanoes in the Azores would produce large tsunamis. What's more likely, though, and there is evidence for it, is a meteor impact in the Atlantic Ocean. And there's evidence of large waves along the East Coast, which seem to be produced by impacts.
Now the simplistic question for you, John. Why are there earthquakes? I mean, what is it about planets and the formation of planets that creates this kind of constant chaos?
Well, what is happening on our planet, as I mentioned before, as it cools down, the outer layer are these large plates which are slowly moving. And it's probably because of the inside of the planet is convecting, it's cooling, and the plates right on top of the convection. Again, very much like oatmeal. But because we live on a sphere, at times these plates have to crash into each other. Excuse me. That they sometimes crash into each other. And where they crash and grind against each other, that's where we get the earthquakes. And that's also where we get almost all of the volcanoes.
Let's talk a little bit about planet formation and geophysics. I've always been fascinated about this, Doctor, that when these planets formed, first of all, started as what, just gas?
Yes. I mean, when we look out across the cosmos, across the night sky, we're able to see places where planets are forming around stars. And there's dust and gas, and it condenses because of gravity. And then they start sort of colliding with each other. And we are seeing planets that are forming.
For all this to form and harden into some physical structure, and it's happening all around the universe, I have a very difficult time understanding the Big Bang Theory of something from nothing exploding, and then we have all this physical mass out here, this hardened Earth, this planet, with oceans and rock and mountains. It's really difficult to comprehend, isn't it?
Well, you're not alone in that. However, we are probably very close to coming up with answers, with answers to those very fundamental questions. And it's I think we talked about this a little bit the last time when I was on your show about the multiverse.
Yes.
That seems to be sort of the key element here about the creation of our universe.
Is it possible that something, now you put all the mass of the universe together, not the dark matter, but what we know, is it possible that there was an object, a structure, a planet, whatever, so big, so immense, almost universal in size, that that's what blew up? And then all these little particles, stars, planets, are the remnants of that one object.
Well, this is the value of the large collider over in CERN,
trying to
answer that question. And, of course, people talk about the Big Bang as if it was an explosion, but it's not an explosion like dynamite. The big hurdle a person has to get over is that space is a physical thing. Even if it may not contain any matter, it still has a potential energy field to it. And we speak of it as space-time continuum, and we speak of zero energy values fluctuating. And the physics, I'm impressed by how much of this physics is getting worked out right now. It's not definitive, but I'm very impressed by how far people have come with it. The very crucial question, and this may steer us too far, Sean Carroll at Caltech has been pounding on people for a long time, and it's this idea of entropy. It's not Big Bang and creation of matter. It's why was the early universe have so much order to it, and then it goes into such a disordered state? This cannot continue. What happened prior to being so ordered? Why does it have such a low entropy at the beginning of time?
And it has a great one now.
And it has a huge. And the other kicker that Sean talks about is almost all of the entropy in our universe is in those galactic black holes, like 95% of it. And the rest of the stars and planets, and you look at my bookcase and you go out to my shed, that entropy is very, very small. Now, this gets back to all the mathematics of black holes and what entropy means, but I think Sean is pointing to some very key questions here, and he's probably close to answering them.
All right, well, stick around, folks. We're going to come back with a final hour to go with Dr. John Dvorak, his book, The Last Volcano. I want you to put your science hats on now. We're going to talk about earthquakes and volcanoes and take your questions. By the looks of things, the phones are ringing off the hook as we speak. It's just a fascinating subject. And you know, our geologist friend Jim Berklin predicts earthquakes, he says. One of the things he used to do is look in the newspaper at disappearing animals, dogs and cats, who just took off for the hills. And he was always able to pinpoint that, hey, they feel an earthquake coming. We'll be back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM.